Thank you, Corbin, for calling and asking what you could read. And I suggested that he read the 16th chapter there of Matthew, and specifically the last four or five verses that he read are going to be verses of interest to us very shortly. If I've spelled that correctly, ekklesia, that may be one of the few Greek words that you're actually familiar with, and maybe one of the few Greek words that you actually know what the meaning of that is. For those of you who may not know what the Greek word ekklesia is translated as, that is the Greek word we find in the New Testament translated as the church. More properly defined, or more specifically defined, it's translated as the called out, or it means those who are called out. In lieu of the things that have happened in my family this past week, there's a lot of things that have run through my mind, and I thought that there would be some things that perhaps might give me some inspiration for what it was I was going to speak with you about this morning. And the more I thought about it, the more I witnessed the outpouring of love from this congregation in so many ways this past week, it came back to the idea of ekklesia. It came back to the idea of the church. It came back to the idea that what the church is something special. That what the church is something unlike anything else we find anywhere in the world. Now, if you were to look up the word church in Webster's dictionary, you would not find the biblical definition for the word church. If you were to look up the word church in Webster's dictionary, you would find the definition that is something real close to a building in which religious activities are held. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times we slip into that use of the word. And that's not really the rock in my shoe that I'm trying to dig out today, but a lot of times I'll hear people say, well, I'll meet you at the church at 10 o'clock. Well, that's not a biblically correct definition of the word church, and I'm not saying that you've committed an egregious sin or anything like that. But if we are to use these words biblically, we need to understand what the church is. We need to understand what its true meaning is. And we need to understand, really more than anything, just how special and important it is and how it needs to be treasured and how it needs to be taken care of. And that's what I'd like to take my few moments this morning talking to you about. God has established for us three institutions, and I know you've heard this from this pulpit many times. He's established a civil government, he's established the family, and he's established the church. And although the family may be the most important in a sense that the other two feed off the structure of the family, the church was in fact established to provide a safe haven for our souls, to provide security for our souls. And the church can be traced back all the way to the beginning of the Old Testament. God, through his love, looked down on humanity and saw how sinful we were. And he realized that man needed to be saved from his sin. So he decided that he was going to create a royal priesthood, as we find in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. And the story starts all the way in the Garden of Eden with two people. And it goes all the way to the end of Revelation, where it describes the city of God, where all those who are faithful will one day reside. And as we trace the idea of ekklesia throughout the Old Testament, it really begins with Abraham, a man who was called to be the leader of a great nation, to be the father of a great nation. In Genesis 18 and 18, it says all the nations would be on the earth would be blessed. And Abraham was called to be the father of many nations. And God was, in fact, the master architect of ekklesia, or of the chosen people, or of his church, as we find in the Old Testament, more specifically as the children of Israel. Now, the church was not found in the Old Testament, so to speak. I don't want to be unclear about that. But the idea of the things that he was doing with the nation of Israel in the Old Testament is a foreshadowing of God preparing his people for the church or the ecclesia that was to come about, the called out, so to speak. We find the children of Israel being down in Egypt for many, many years, going through many trials, being tempered, so to speak, all in an effort to condition them, to build them up, to prepare them for the things that they were going to endure. On the eve of their deliverance out of Egypt, as we're going to study on our Sunday morning class, here probably in just another month or so, we find that the Passover lamb took place. And we find in Exodus, the 12th chapter, the 6th verse, and I thought Art might be reading that, but I don't know that he read the 6th verse. In Exodus chapter 12, it says, "Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation, That is the first place where we find the word ekklesia actually used. Now, the Septuagint was the Greek version of the Old Testament, and the Septuagint used the word ekklesia many times in the Old Testament. And it was talking there in Exodus 12 and 6 about the assembly. And we can already see God setting aside a specific portion of His people to be His redeemed, to be His holy people, to be His chosen people, to be His special people. And as they were on the eve of their deliverance, they went over, and you're familiar with the fact that they had to put the blood on the door so that the angel would pass over and know, in fact, who was saved and who was not. And Paul, in Acts the 20th chapter, the 28th verse, talks about the fact that it was the blood of Christ that saved him. It was always blood that saved. And we can see things happening in the Old Testament that are a precursor to that. In Hosea chapter 9, verse 10, we see the nation of Israel there described as a corporate body, I believe, if I understand that correctly. And it's throughout the Old Testament, through the prophets and through all the things that the children of Israel went through. They were being balanced by the schoolmaster, by the law, as Galatians describes the law as the schoolmaster, and by God's love. And it was a constant back and forth of the children of Israel misbehaving, God disciplining them, God loving them, God rewarding them when they did good. It was a back and forth. It was a balance. And I believe it was all a conditioning of those people for Jesus Christ, for the establishment of the church. And it finally had come time for the ecclesia, for those who are called out to be established in the form of the church. And that was necessary for Jesus Christ to come and establish. And in the womb of Mary, Jesus Christ came down and was born. And I find it interesting that so many people like Jesus when he's in the manger. When we get to certain times of the year, that's everybody's favorite story. Everybody likes to talk about Jesus in the manger, but nobody wants to talk about, or fewer people want to talk about Jesus as an adult. It's because when Jesus grew up, Jesus began to require things from people. When Jesus grew up, he began to establish things. And as Corbin read for us in Matthew, the 16th chapter, one of the things that Christ did, in fact, establish was the church. Jesus Christ came, and in Luke, the 9th chapter, the 31st verse, he says, he spoke of his decree, which was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. When Jesus finally hung there on the cross, all the steps had been taken for the church to begin. And it was just a few short weeks after that, in the 2nd chapter of the book of Acts, that we find the establishment of the church. But if you'll turn back to Matthew 16, or maybe your Bibles are still there from Corbin's reading, we find Jesus Christ establishing the church. Excuse me, not establishing the church, but speaking of the establishment of the church that was soon to come and how that was going to happen. Beginning in verse 17, Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." It's nobody else's church, it's his church. And if you're part of the church, you are the bride of Christ. "And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Now, a lot of people think the idea of ecclesia, or the idea of the church, is so naive. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul there talks about people who consider the foolishness of the cross. They consider it foolish. And they consider the wisdom of men to be what is important. Ecclesia, the idea of the church, is a simple concept. It's a simple concept, but it's a biblical concept. And it's not outdated. And it's not naive to think that it can't still exist, because you guys are living proof that it does. The temple, which was such a prominent factor in the Old Testament, was built upon stones. It was built out of stones. But in 1 Peter, the 2nd chapter, it's no longer the stones of the temple that matter. It's the living stones, as God's people are described, that matter. We are living stones. Our bodies are the temple of God. There is no longer a temple as there was in the Old Testament, but we become that temple. You know, we need to understand that the apostles weren't acting as if Jesus were alive, but they were acting and doing what they did because he was in fact alive. And that was their motivation for all that they did. And it should be our motivation for all that we do. The church can be established and can be built in any location where there is righteous obedience taking place. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 26, I believe we find what in fact the church is to manifest. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 26, says that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that he should be holy and without blemish. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, the word my, or the pronoun my, is used there. This is in fact Christ's church, and it is nobody else's church. In Acts 20 and 28, it says, feed the church of God which he hath purchased with his own blood. The word church in the Gospels is only found two times. It's found in Matthew chapter 16, and then it's found again in Matthew chapter 18, verse 17. But the idea of the church, or the idea of ecclesia being translated as church, becomes more and more prominent after Acts chapter 2 as we go throughout the epistles that Paul and some of the other followers of Christ wrote. It's an important concept for us to understand. And I know on some level it may be basic for some of us, but it may not be basic for all of us. Whether it's basic or not, it's important. It's important because the church is, in fact, the most important thing, I think, that we need to understand, that we need to realize. It's the bride of Christ. It was purchased with his own blood. And the church is to function in a specific way. And we have specific offices and we have specific roles outlined in the New Testament that are to take place in the church. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 1, it talks there of the elders, the deacons, and the members. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, it talks about the evangelists. The church is to be comprised of these things. Not that one is more important than the other in the sight of God, although elders do have a specific role to watch out for our souls. But these four things are the four, quote, functions or offices I find within the church and none other. Those four things. I'd like to say one thing about the idea of the use of the word church in the New Testament. Sometimes it's referred to in the universal sense, and sometimes it's referred to in the local sense. And I didn't write it down specifically, but I believe it's about a 4-to-1 ratio in use in favor of universal as opposed to local when we find it in the New Testament. But that doesn't diminish the importance of understanding the difference between the universal church and the local church. And there is an importance in the local church. And one of the things that I think sometimes gets muddled or gets muddy a little bit is the idea of membership. Because I don't believe the word membership in and of itself is actually found in the New Testament. And sometimes you'll come across people who don't believe that being a member of a local congregation is important. But I would like to turn to Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and just read a couple of verses and just make a couple of comments about that. Because I don't think the argument that a specific word that we use isn't used in the New Testament is licensed to say that it's not necessary. The word Trinity and many others aren't technically found in the Bible, but we use them because it helps us to understand the principles that we need to convey. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 7, it says, remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct. Skipping down to verse 17, it says, obey those who rule over you, and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give an account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. Now, as I read these two verses, it becomes difficult for me to understand how these relationships can work and how these commandments can actually be conducted if leadership or rulers don't have any idea who it is that they are to be watching out for. If they don't have any idea who it is that is under their watch. Likewise, how is it that we can know who it is that we are to obey if we haven't affiliated ourselves with a local congregation and a local group of elders? So I think it's just something that as sometimes we're required to relocate into different areas or vice versa, that we understand that as quickly and as appropriately as possible, I think it is appropriate for us to find a faithful congregation and to identify ourselves with it. Not because we've all of a sudden become something different, not because we've all of a sudden become saved because we've done that, but because we have a responsibility to our leaders, and our leaders have a responsibility to us, and the only way those kind of things can be carried out is if there's an understanding of exactly who it is that they are to watch for and who it is that we are to obey. So I just wanted to say a few words about the idea of local membership. This is really what I want to talk about for my last few minutes this morning. And this is just the idea of how thankful we should be for the church. And what a blessing the church actually is. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, and this is a familiar passage, but if you turn with me, I'd like to read a few passages out of Deuteronomy chapter 6. Beginning in verse 3. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit on your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. I work for a privately held company, and in 3 years it's going to be 100 years old, and it's in the process of virtually all of the control of that company is almost been handed over to the third generation now. And as I was in college doing some case studies on privately held companies, it's interesting that when a privately held company gets to the third generation, it's very often sold. It very often is sold and goes public. So you can imagine that there's a lot of people around our place at work that are worried about this. And I'm not going to worry about this because somebody told me just not too long ago that, you know, worrying is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but you don't really go anywhere. And so worrying about it isn't going to do any good in this case. But the idea I wanted to bring out was this idea of a third generation. And I think part of the reason that a third generation oftentimes sells a company is because a third generation doesn't have the feeling of building the company from the ground up. They don't have the feeling of being involved from the ground up that the first two generations do. And so they're not invested in it quite as closely as the father and the grandfather would be. And as we contemplate the idea of the church, I know we're well more than three generations away from Acts chapter 2. But because we're many generations away from the establishment of something, we need to understand that it's no less important now than it was then. And we need to understand that it's no less important to us now as it was to them then. And we need to understand that our fathers and our grandfathers have done a lot of work in the church, and they've left a lot of good things to us. And we need to make sure that we carry that on to the next generation, as Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7 tells us. We need to understand how precious this idea of the church is, how special the relationships of the church are, because that's really what the church is. The church is a network of relationships. The church isn't a list of assets. It isn't our building, it isn't the ground, it isn't the chairs you're sitting in. The church is the people. And I know a lot of times a lot of frustrations can come about in the church. And the reason a lot of times people can get frustrated with the church is because the church is the people. And as soon as you add people to anything, it's not going to be perfect any longer. But the people, the church, is what it's all about. We don't need to be picky about all the little things. We need to keep our eye on the ball and understand what's important. We need to understand that the church is the bride of Christ. And if you've taken the steps to be a part of the church, then you're part of something that is so special. You're part of something that is just unlike anything else that you can possibly be a part of. There are so many people who go to such great lengths to be identified with worldly organizations that are meaningless in the end. And yet anybody, regardless of your background, can be a part of this. And I don't even want to call it an organization because I don't think that's the right word. I don't even know how to describe the church because it's divine. And when you try to describe things that are divine, human words often fall short. But it's something special. It's something special. And it's open to anybody. That's what's even more special about it. The best thing that you can belong to in the whole world is open to anybody who wants to be a part of it. It's not like a country club where they have all these rules about who's important and who's not in their eyes. I think we do a good job here of understanding that and evaluating that. But I just wanted to drive that home because when we understand how special this is that we have, when we understand how special it is to be a part of something, it just motivates you to want to do the best you can. It just motivates you to want to do the best for it that you can. It's the bride of Christ. Tom Woody once told me, I was listening to him teach a class once, and I had to laugh at this, and I shouldn't laugh at it because I'm not married, but he said, how would a wife feel if her husband was always asking, well, how much time do I have to spend with my wife? How would that make her feel to have her husband always asking that question? Well, should we ask that question about being with the church? How much time do I have to be with the church? How much time do you want to be with the church? How much time do you want to be with the church? The church being the bride of Christ. I oftentimes hear people say, I mean, not oftentimes, but from time to time I hear people say that people at church are just so nice. I agree. There's a lot of people that are worldly that are nice. I work with a lot of worldly people that I consider to be nice. But what makes people at church special is that they have a foundation. They have a core. They are a living stone that's been built on the foundation that Jesus laid. That is what makes them nice. That is just a fruit of the Spirit, like so many other things that people do. Being nice in and of itself doesn't make you holy. But being holy hopefully will make you nice. I know that a lot of this is probably elementary material, but I was moved by the outpouring of love this week, by the number of people that came and
it's just a special thing to be part of the church. And if you're not, you need to think about why you're not. We can help you. Please come forward as we stand and sing.